I'd like to thank you all for being here tonight, both Division of Wildlife Resources staff, thank you for being here, and fishermen and friends of fishermen, and bow fishermen. Thank you all for being here. My name is Fred Oswald. I am the chairperson of the Central RAC Committee, and I am also representing non-consumptive users, and we will start over with Richard and have the other RAC members introduce themselves and tell you who they represent. Richard?
Richard Hanson, at large.
Gary Nelson, sportsman.
Dwayne Smith, non-consumptive.
Sarah Flinders, Forest Service.
Tim Fair, at large.
Chris Marble, at large.
And we do have seven members here tonight, and that makes a quorum, so we're able to conduct business. Yay! In the back of the room, there are agendas. If you didn't happen to pick one up, we only do have one action item, and that is the fishing guidebook and rule tonight. But if you'd like to pick up an agenda, there are copies in the back there. And also, we invite you to, at the appropriate time, to ask questions or make a comment on the presentation tonight. And if you would like to make a comment, I would invite you to fill out one of these yellow comment cards. They're also in the back of the room. And just let us know who you are and what you want to speak about. And then we have the comment card for our records. So thank you very much for filling one of these out before it's your turn to speak. I'd like to just briefly go over the meeting framework with you tonight so everybody knows how it's going to work. We only have one action item, and for that item, somebody from the Division of Wildlife Resources will give a presentation on that action item, the fishing guidebook and rule, offering some background information and then what the proposal is. At the end of the presentation, I will ask RAC members if they have any questions or clarification on the presentation. And then after that, I will ask you as audience members if you have any questions for the presenter or clarification on what he presented. After that, I'll close the question period and then open it up to comments from the public. If you are representing an organization, we'd like you to keep your remarks to under 5 minutes, be as concise as you can. And if you are representing yourself, we'd like you to be concise within the 3 minute limit. I notice there are a bunch of you here from the organization, and if somebody has already said what you want to say, no need to repeat that, but on the other hand, we'd like to hear from everybody tonight, and if you have something you'd like to say to the division and to the RAC, we're more than happy to hear from you. Once all the comments have been accepted, I will close the comment period time, bring it back to the RAC, and the RAC will discuss it and then offer motions in terms of what our recommendations will be to the Wildlife Board. And the Wildlife Board, in its next meeting, will then take up this action item. And you all are also invited, if you wish to attend that meeting. And John Fairchild is going to tell us when that meeting is.
I am on it. We have actually an emergency one tomorrow, but that's certainly not going to be it.
It's November 1st.
Is it November? There you go.
November 1st. So the Wildlife Board will be taking up this action item and the fishing rule at their November 1st meeting. So without further delay, we will go ahead and get into our agenda. The first action item is the approval of the agenda and minutes. RAC members, do you have any additions or corrections to last time's minutes? If not, I would entertain a motion to accept the minutes and the agenda for this evening. A motion by Gary and a second by Duane. Further discussion? All those in favor? And that passes unanimously. And we'll next go to a Wildlife Board meeting update. This is the time when basically I offer some summary about what the Wildlife Board did at its last meeting. And by way of doing that, I will first refresh RAC members' memories in terms of what we did. At our last meeting, we only had three items. We approved the bobcat harvest recommendations unanimously. We approved the waterfowl guidebook and rule unanimously. And we approved the Great Salt Lake Waterfowl Management Area Management Plan unanimously. So those are the three things we did. The Wildlife Board had a lot more to talk about, and they actually had a number of different motions. And John Baer was not able to be with us tonight, but I'll do my best to go through this. And John, if you have any corrections, let me know. First of all, there was a motion from a board member that the division do an expeditious review of data to provide board members with analysis, conclusions, and recommendations concerning possible over-harvest of female cougars. And that motion passed unanimously. So there will be a review of the division and presented back to the board on whether, in fact, there is an ongoing harvest of female cougars.
That information will be provided to the board tomorrow in an emergency meeting.
Okay, thank you.
That's one of the agenda items.
Then second of all, there was a motion that we accept, that the board accept the bobcat harvest recommendations as presented. We passed that unanimously, and the board did as well. Then there was a motion to put the issue of swans and sandhill cranes on the board action log to see if there might be additional take in other parts of the state. And that motion passed unanimously, so the board will take that item up on their action log to see if there might be additional permits for swans and sandhill cranes. And then there was a motion to accept the division's recommendations on the waterfowl guidebook. We passed that unanimously, and the board did as well. Then there was a motion. Let me just take a step backwards. Most of the meeting had to do with the conservation permits and permit allocations. And there were some lengthy discussions about that that resulted in quite a few motions, and I'll just go through those. And that did not come before us. It went right to the board for their consideration. And Chris, if you have any additions or corrections, chime in, okay? There was a motion.
One, Fred. That was regarding the convention permits rather than the conservation permits.
Thank you. There was a motion to approve the conservation permit allocation for the 2013-15 conventions or conservation permits, with the addition of 20 antlerless elk permits to be distributed at the discretion of the division. And that passed unanimously. So there will be an additional 20 antlerless permits distributed with the conservation permit allocation. Then there was a motion to accept the division's recommendation adding the contract stipulation for annual report to include the total amount of funds raised by the application fee, the cost of administering the drawing, and expenditures on wildlife conservation activities. There was some concern by a number of people who attended the board meeting that the public weren't receiving enough data about those, about what was happening to the $5 fee that was being charged at the convention. So this motion went to that, and the motion was to report the total amount of funds collected by the $5 fee at the convention, the cost of administering the drawing at the convention, and the expenditures, and what that $5 went for, the expenditures that went back into wildlife activities. Does that all make sense? And then there was a motion to accept the conservation permit audit as presented by the division. That passed unanimously. And a motion to approve the conservation permit allocation. That's the number of permits. And that passed unanimously. And then...
This first one was conservation permits and not convention permits, where they wanted the audit to be more detailed. This is still a package with conservation permits, not the convention.
Yeah. And
correct. I mean, you were.
Yeah, I guess everybody understands the difference between conservation and convention permits. Okay. Then there was a motion. Then there was a proposal by the United Wildlife Cooperative. And with regard to that proposal, there was a motion by the board to move that we add to the action log a request that the division meet with the Mule Deer Foundation, the Sportsman for Fish and Wildlife, and the United Wildlife Cooperative, both individually and collectively, to identify issues of concern and discuss possible voluntary changes to the current contract. The division will report back to the board within 1 year. That came about because the contract with the Mule Deer Foundation and SFW goes through 2015. And so it's not possible, according to legal counsel, that could be reopened again. And so... That's why the board moved to try and meet in an informal way with those people who are running the convention now, plus the Wildlife Cooperative, to see if there might be some voluntary changes immediately or within the next year that could happen before the convention is permitted.
Convention
is reauthorized. So anyway, Chris, do you want to add anything to that, to Rex?
Part of the motion was that part of the proposal was that the funds generated from that mirror the conservation program, and that 10% of the funds go directly back to expo organizers, and 90% of the funds are split either via funds directly back to the division or through approved projects and would be accounted for. That was part of that proposal. And of course, what you had mentioned, Fred, was the result of that.
Yeah, and at the present time, there's nothing in the contract that says anything about how much of those funds should go either for the drawing or for the convention or for wildlife projects. And so I think the cooperative was trying to say there ought to be more detail in terms of how much of the money that comes in from the drawing is allocated to each place. And that's not going to happen until 2015, but there may be something informally that could happen. Right now, there's a lot more money that goes into the drawing itself and to the convention than 10%.
Yeah, and in addition to that, the Mule Deer Foundation voluntarily provided some accounting for the last 2 years as far as what was happening there, and had voluntarily said that they would provide that on an ongoing basis. That doesn't have a designated split as far as what goes to what, but they did volunteer that information and said they would on an annual basis.
Okay, well, it...
Fred. Fred, I have...
Yeah.
Is any of this going to come to the racks? Any of this information, any of the proposed changes, anything?
If there's a rule change, it would come back to the RAC.
Okay.
And a lot of this would
be what I understand said last time is that they wanted to discuss it on the Wildlife Board and then send it back to the RACs. So it looks like to me they've done a leap and they've bypassed the RACs. Because they've made some, sounds like they've made some proposals that are that the RACs need to consider.
Yeah, I think the reason this didn't come, the board didn't send this to the RACs before it went to the board this last meeting, was because the contract is not up for renewal. And so while the United Wildlife Cooperative wanted to talk about it, basically the Attorney General's office said, you guys can go ahead and talk about it, but the contract with the Mule Deer Foundation and Sportsmen for Fish and Wildlife, they have a contract through 2015. So most likely the next time the RACs will hear it is when that contract comes back up.
So they could make some changes voluntarily, right? Is that what you're saying, the Mule Deer Foundation and SFW?
Yeah, I think that the Mule Deer Foundation and SFW said at the meeting that they were certainly willing to sit down and talk, but if everybody realized that they do have a contract, so something may happen between now and 2015, and on the other hand, something may not. But at least they've agreed to sit down and talk.
The big issue is accountability for the funds.
Yeah,
and
I know.
SFW and Mule Deer Foundation have contributed significantly to wildlife conservation. I think they wanted, the various groups just wanted to see all of that in writing, and you know, there's a lot of information sharing that has to take place before people are more comfortable with where it is right now, and I believe that's kind of the first step, is to share all the facts, and once you know the facts, then decide whether or not we have a problem. You know, whether an individual group has a problem with it or not. So it gets pretty complicated. And this group is all about fishing, so they don't want to hear about it.
No, okay. So let's get on with fishing. But I think it's important for the RAC members to know what goes on at board meetings, and this was a significant deal that went on, so I wanted to report that back. Before we go on to the regional update from John, Matt came in late. Matt, will you introduce yourself?
My name is Matt Clark. I'm a sportsman's rep.
Thank you very much. And now we'll have our regional update from John Fairchild in terms of what's been happening in the central region since the last time we met.
I guess we're on. Okay, take this off so I can read. I'll go through section by section various programs that we have going and try to highlight, you know, from our last meeting. In our wildlife section, you've probably heard a lot about the coyote bounty program and check-in and all of that. If you've been out bow hunting carp, maybe you don't even care about that either. But anyway, you do that too? Well, see, you don't get paid for doing the carp. You get paid for taking coyotes. Just some numbers. Since the check-in program started in the 1st of September, number of people submitting coyotes, 82. Number of coyotes submitted, 453. Average number of coyotes per person, 2.5. And the maximum for one person was 45. This is statewide. Yeah, we've had check-in facilities in Tooele, and we've got one planned this week in Nephi, and we've held one in our Salt Lake or in our Springville office, and we've had very very few turned in to Springville, but. You can imagine Nephi and Tooele will probably be where most of them show up. Another issue, and made the news this week, Highland City announced that they're opening up their city limits to archery hunting. That was kind of a first step in order to work with us to come up with a proposal for involving archers in taking antlerless deer in areas where they're creating a problem. We don't have a plan, we don't have an agreement, but we made the news anyway. So we're working through that. That's a sensitive issue. You get 50% of the people in any neighborhood want the little rats taken care of, and 50% of them protected them as if they were kids. You know, so you can imagine, you know, the issues that the city will have to work through, not us, to deal with that problem. Upland game hunts have started: forest grouse, doves, rabbits. These doves are on through September. Chukar season will start the 29th, quail and pheasant November 3rd. And the Wildlife Board tomorrow will be addressing additional antlerless elk and bison permits in their emergency meeting. That will, and it's drought related, you know, in areas where forage has been limited. There are places where livestock cuts might be made, and also elk cuts through permits. In our habitat section, we're working with private landowners, state and federal agencies on numerous fire reseeding projects statewide, and in our region we've got about four or five significant fires. The biggest one that you'll remember is that Wood Hollow fire down by Fountain Green. I got some preliminary numbers from the guys working up the projects. There were over 40,000 acres burned cooperatively with private landowners and BLM. We plan on seeding close to 25,000 acres. We'll use an anchor chain to cover the seed on about 12,000 to 13,000 acres. A huge project, and the area should benefit down the road from getting that kind of attention. It's significant that we're working with so many private landowners down there to get that done. It's all winter range, and critical for deer in that country, so we're hoping that comes together. Strawberry Highlands development, we're working with Wasatch County, evaluating the impacts of a 7,000 acre development over there by Soldier Creek. And the impact that would have on fish, wildlife, and sportsmen, you know, hunters and anglers, recommending ways to lessen the impacts there. Since we're mostly aquatics here tonight, I have a few more items for the aquatic section, and this group over here chime in if I misspeak. One thing they didn't say, but I know, fishing improves as the water temperatures drop, so don't forget to go fishing. You know, not that I have to tell this group that. Yuba Fishery Working Group continues to meet, and we are trying to come up with a way to determine, you know, if we can develop a quality fishery that will attract anglers to Yuba while maintaining existing water rights, other uses, and if so, develop and implement a plan. That's right out of our purpose statement. The next meeting of the group is September 17th. Trying to avoid the boom-bust cycle of the fishery at Yuba. Working with all those that influence that. Silver Lake Stabilization Project was completed. That was a cooperative project with the Forest Service. And we appreciate that support. And it's an effort to maintain a natural-looking lake. You said a natural lake. It is a natural lake, right? Support brook trout grayling and possibly native cutthroat, the Bonneville cutthroat. Sandpitch restoration project. After the high flows of 2011, there was a need to go back into an area where we had worked with a private landowner to do some stream restoration work, and that's been completed. That was a couple of weeks worth of heavy equipment work. And I'll get to another aspect of that in a minute. The June sucker recruitment is documented at Red Butte Reservoir. That's the first time since it was filled in 2006. Correct? Good. And fall stocking of rainbows at community fishing ponds has started and will go through the month. The fire and drought impacts on fisheries is something that our guys are real concerned about. That wood hollow fire devastated a brown trout fishery in the Sandpitch River. It greatly reduced the native fish populations. It's one thing to rehab the land, but when you get that much erosion and sediment yield going into aquatic systems, it takes a long time for those systems to bounce back. Hopefully the work that we did down there will facilitate that, because I imagine some of that was bank stabilization as a result of the high flows. Reservoirs are okay in the central region due to the carryover in 2011, but lake levels could be a problem in 2013 if we have another dry winter. I noticed a couple guys here that probably interested in me saying something about their FLW National Guard College Fishing Series Western Regional Championship on Utah Lake September 1st. Evidently that was a success. Our guys didn't win. Looks like CSU Long Beach took first. The bagging daily weights, 8 pounds, 5 ounces, 5 pounds, 14, 7 pounds, 5, gave the winning team 21 pounds, 8 ounces, and I think we were worried initially that there was not going to be enough fish for them to weigh. So evidently the largemouth bass there at Utah Lake came through. Conservation outreach, Kokanee Salmon Viewing Day, Strawberry, September 22nd. Hunter Ed Plus mentored hunts are going to be the 22nd, 23rd of this month, and then October 12th and 13th. You got anything else, Scott?
Raptor viewing day is the 22nd as well at the Orm Overlook on the Squaw Peak Trail Road.
There you go.
That's a busy day.
You're going to be in three places at once, aren't you? Law enforcement. There's been some news, and it's true, that multiple shootings and poisonings of bald and golden eagles in Utah seems to be on the rise, resulted in a $2,500 reward, and it was covered today by the Associated Press. So we have some cases ongoing there. And so far, deer and elk archery hunts are going okay, low number of violations. That's the weekend update.
Thank you. And for those of you who are on Facebook, the DWR has a really nice Facebook page on Facebook. I encourage you to friend them, and then you get to see all that they're doing. And you also get to see Scott Root's great photo of some Kokanee salmon. So good job on the photography.
I didn't see a great picture of me.
Well, I don't know about that.
A picture of you.
Two other things before we go to our action item. I've been serving as the representative of all of the RACs on the CWMU committee, and my term just ended, and I'm happy to announce that another one of our members, Gary Nelson, is going to be taking my place and representing all of the RACs on the CWMU committee. So congratulations, Gary. I know you'll do a great job, and good luck with that. And finally, we're always appreciative of members of the Wildlife Board who come to our RAC meeting. John Baer, who is one of the central region board members, usually is with us tonight, and he phoned me this afternoon and said he was unable to be here. But I'm happy to acknowledge that Cal Crandall is here tonight. Cal, thank you for being here. He is the other board member representing the central region, and we're happy to have you with us tonight. Thank you. And now we'll go ahead and move on to our action item. Reminder, if you want to offer some statements on this, be sure and fill out one of these yellow cards. You can get them in the back of the room. And send them up, yep. And tonight we're going to be dealing with the Fishing Guidebook and Rule 657R13. And representing DWR is going to be Drew Cushing, Aquatic Program Coordinator, and thanks for being here.
Thank you. Thank you, Fred. And I just wanted to thank the public. This is maybe a record for the Central Region for the most people I've seen, so thank you. Like Fred said, this is our annual fall meeting to discuss recommendations for rule changes in the upcoming year. First of all, this is actually a statute change. This is 2320-8. This is our waste of wildlife statute. And what we would like to do is allow for the disposal of common carp, which are an overabundant and problematic fish in many of our fisheries, including one down the road, Utah Lake. And how to dispose of these, according to the code, is kind of an issue. And so what we would like to do is allow people to dispose of them as they see fit. Likewise, the second one is to allow the disposal of species of fish that have been designated catch and kill. These are fish that have been illegally introduced into waters that we don't want to manage. And as such, you know, there's always been an issue since we started implementing this regulation with what do the anglers do with these fish. According to code, it's against law to throw them away. But at the same time, it's against the law to throw them away alive. And that's, you know, if they're not going to keep them, we'd like them to kill them and return them to the water. And so we would like to have the Wildlife Board approve those species of fish that have that regulation on them and in those waters where those limits occur. And so it would be designated by the Wildlife Board. R-657-13-6, this is part of our fishing rule. Right now we have some inconsistencies. We have two waters with a limit of 3 hooks per line, Lake Powell and Flaming Gorge, and then the rest of the state you can only have 2. And there's been a lot of interest in this setup that you see to the right. This is basically a 3-fly setup that anglers have started using a couple years ago. What they do is they have a fly that rests on top of the water, and then one in mid-column, and then a nymph down below. And they would like to use those in Utah, and it's actually a good way to fish. Likewise, the setup on the lower left is a worm harness that I have in my tackle box and is illegal to use. It's sold commercially in many stores. And a lot of anglers would like to use them in Utah, and they do no harm. You know, they're used in other states, and it's just inconsistent. And then the middle upper is called an umbrella rig, and there is an interest in Utah to use them. Right now they're legal to use, but you have to clip all but 2 hooks off in some waters in order to get your 3 hooks because they're sold in a package of 5, and they resemble a school of bait fish swimming through the water. And so right now at Lake Powell, for instance, you would have to clip off 2 of those hooks in order to be legal. And if in the rest of the state, except for Flaming Gorge, you'd have to clip off 3. And so just to make this standard with, you know, statewide, simplify our regulations just a little bit and make it a little bit easier on our anglers, we'd like to just standardize to 3 hooks statewide. This was in our survey this year, one of the most popular comments that we had back from our anglers, and until this happened I really didn't understand that there was even a desire to bowfish for common carp at night. Apparently there is, and it's really popular back east. We have a whole side here that would like to pursue this. This is one that it's for a fish species that in many waters is overpopulated and creates an issue with our sport fish. And then again at night, you know, it's an itch, or it's an area and a time of day when other anglers aren't out there, and it's basically a new avenue for anglers to go out there and you know, basically get rid of a fish that overpopulates and creates issues for us. So we'd like to allow bow fishing for common carp at night with the use of a light. This is just bookkeeping. We have gizzard shad, which are prohibited in our list of prohibited fish species statewide. But in our same proclamation, our guidebook, they're allowed as bait at Lake Powell. And so basically we'd like to just, you know, make those consistent and just tidy that up somewhat. Now just region by region, the northern region, the first one, They had two regulations up on Willard Bay. They had one for the reservoir proper and then one for the inlet channel. And both the anglers and our law enforcement officers would like to just make that consistent for both. It makes it more simple to manage, more simple to enforce those regulations. And so basically this would just come out. And so the inlet channel at Willard Bay would have the same limit and same limits and regulations as the reservoir proper. Blacksmith Fork, this was an extensive work group with the anglers up there, the Cache Valley anglers, and this is a river that has overabundant brown trout, and as an incentive to get support from the anglers, what they agreed to is this double limit, which is a limit of eight trout, and if at least four brown trout, and then have a restrictive one fish limit of over 15. And this was to get their buy-in and try and remove fish. And it's kind of an experiment. Typically, our fly anglers, which this group is, don't like to harvest fish and really are a catch-and-release-oriented group. But they agreed to this regulation in the effort to try and reduce numbers and increase size of those brown trout in the Blacksmith Fork. The Weber River, and this is from the Great Salt Lake to Echo Reservoir Dam. There's a small population of Bonneville cutthroat in that stretch. They're in the main stem, but they travel up into the tribs and spawn. And right now, according to the regulations, they can be kept just like other trout. There's a lot of importance placed on these fish being able to supply populations to those upper tribs, and as such, we'd like to have them all released so that anglers can't take those home as they can right now. Holmes Creek Reservoir, this is an in-town reservoir in Layton, and it gets a lot of pressure, and as such, we want to keep largemouth bass in there so that they'll recruit at least once, and as such, just have a six bass limit, but you may take only one bass that's over 12 inches home. Central region, this is where you guys live. Deer Valley Lakes, this is a really popular lake. It gets a lot of pressure, a lot of harvest. As such, it's recommended that the limit be really restrictive so that those fish can be spread around through the anglers more efficiently, and the boom and bust of those plantings would be lessened. Hopefully keep those fish in there just a little bit longer. Blue Lake out by Wendover is a warm water spring lake. It has tilapia, which are an illegally introduced fish out there. We have a catch and kill on them, I believe. Mike? And the spearfishing interests would like to spear for tilapia out there. And, it's one of those that we really don't like the tilapia anyway, and we already have a restrictive regulation, so it would be probably in our best interest to allow this and maybe increase the harvest of those fish in Blue Lake. Utah Lake, this is kind of a supporting regulation of the bow fishing at night. Basically, we have June sucker in Utah Lake that travel up the tribs in the spring to spawn. These are an endangered fish. And the intent of this is to protect those as they go into the tribs and eliminate the bow angling in those tribs, but allow it in the reservoir proper. So basically from sundown to sun up, you cannot bow fish in the tribs from May 1st through the second Saturday in July. Green River, this is an illegal introduction actually from the Yampa in Colorado, and so this is that catch and kill regulation which we tend to put in place for illegally introduced fish, and so that it'd be a no limit on northern pike. You cannot release them alive, and this is a result or our response to an illegal introduction. The walleye, these fish were illegally introduced into Red Fleet Reservoir several years ago. And as such, the same catch and kill regulation, just trying to pass a message to anglers that the result of moving those fish is our non-support of them being there, and hopefully they get the message. The last one, no limit on channel catfish in the Green River, is not for any illegal introduction. It's because they're small, stunted, and there's just gobs of them. And the hope is that if we can get anglers to take more home, that the remaining fish will grow just a little bit larger and actually provide a more attractive fish for anglers to take home and harvest. Because right now they're all about 10 inches. And a 10-inch catfish does not make a good meal unless you have a lot of them. The Vernal Game Farm, this is a community fishery, and as such, we recommend that it has the same limit on as all of our other community fisheries, which is a two-fish limit, regardless of species. Boulder Mountain Lakes, this is really bookkeeping. This is a really complicated place to go fish if you've never been there and you don't live there. And before, it was all turn left at Bob's house and then turn right at Fred's house and go up the road. And what we tried to do, or what we did do, was border it with roads. And so this is the same as your game management units in big game, if you're familiar with those, where you're basically a big box of roads. And so this is no change. It's just trying to simplify things. But in order to make a change, we have to address it here. This is a change. The change is in red. There are two waters down at the lower end. Everything else remains the same. These are just waters where the anglers in southern Utah would like to ice fish. And previously, they were closed. And if the anglers like to ice fish those, we would very much appreciate them going out and ice fishing on those waters. So we'd like to add those to that list. East Fork of Boulder Creek, this is a very politically charged creek down in southern Utah. We treated it once, and because of the politics down there, we've been unable to treat it again. There are a few brook trout in there. We wouldn't like them in there, don't want them in there, and as such, we would like to double the limit so that if anglers do catch them, that they remove them, and there's a liberal limit, so it doesn't look like we're protecting them. What we'd like to do there is reintroduce native cutthroat into there in the end, but we need one more treatment in order to get that done. Fish Lake, this is basically the same limit, just worded differently. Before, this 28-inch limit was specific to lake trout and splake, and what we'd like to do is just simplify the language somewhat and have the same effect on anglers. So you'd have a four-fish limit, only one trout maybe over 28 inches, and the vast majority of the trout that would be over 28 inches would be splake and lake trout. So it would effectively is a lake trout limit. Salina City Pond, this is a community fishery, and as such would have that community fishery two-fish limit, regardless of species. Now, that's the end of the recommendations. What I want to do is just walk you through how we arrived at these recommendations. The survey, we did a statewide survey to start with. This is in place of the spring rack that we had in the past. And the reason we went to this is the attendance at the spring rack historically has been pretty dismal. And so this was a way to hopefully solicit more angler input than we got at the racks and allow anglers a more informal way to let us know how they feel about their issues and give us a better chance to respond to them in a positive way. So on top of the statewide survey, we also received a lot of hard mail from anglers. Each region had one, if not more, open houses. We received a lot of email from anglers. We had people stop in to let us know what they were thinking, had a lot of phone calls, and then heard a lot from the internet forums that are really popular out there for anglers. What we learned, the survey was basically 2 months, or 1 month, from May to June, and 1,367 people participated, which was really a good response for a four-week survey. There were seven questions that were specific to the regulations, which we deemed controversial or that people would have an interest in statewide. And then the last question was just a free-form question to allow people just the chance to let us know what they were thinking with no holds barred. What do you want to see? What do you feel that the division is doing right or wrong? All of the specific recommendations, so all the ones that we're moving forward with, were overwhelmingly supported by the public except Forsyth Reservoir, and this had to do with an illegal introduction. Perch were illegally introduced into Forsyth, and we had some pretty radical thoughts at that time on how to respond to those, because the catch and kill regulation is a way to remove or allow anglers the chance to remove fish wholesale, so there's no limit. Perch are one of those fish that's what people want to do with perch. If you go to a water where there are perch and you're an angler, what you want is to take a bunch home to eat. And so a catch and kill regulation really doesn't do what it should do for certain species of fish. And so what we wanted to do was ask people how they felt about different approaches for these perch in Forsyth. One of them was to close the reservoir to fishing altogether. One of them was to close it to the possession of yellow perch, which if you're a perch fisherman and you can't harvest them, it provides disincentive for that action, and the action is moving them in there. It's really extreme, but we wanted to just know how the public felt. And then the last one, or the second to last one, was the catch and kill regulation. And then we asked them, you know, would you like us to do nothing at all or just leave it as is? And the response was, you know, why wouldn't you want us to take those fish home? You know, we could help you remove perch from Forsyth Reservoir using a catch and kill regulation. And the truth is that anglers can't remove all the perch or remove enough perch to really impact a perch population in a reservoir. And so by their response, it let us know that we have some additional work to do with the anglers and that they really don't understand, what the catch and kill regulation is and what it should be used for. It should be a disincentive, not that they can help biologically remove perch. So we held that one up. There were a total of 746 people that wrote in comments at the end of the survey. And interestingly enough, almost half of the comments wanted more relaxed regulations and the other half wanted more strict regulations. So I don't know whether that means that we're pleasing half the people or we're upset everybody. I'm really not sure. But, you know, it lets us know that we're somewhere in the middle anyway on our regulations in Utah. The only areas of agreement or the real popular feedback that we got was that we need more law enforcement presence statewide. That was just uniformly something that people believed, that the Division of Wildlife doesn't have enough law enforcement out there. Two, that we need more community fisheries. And then three, there is an overwhelming support of additional angler access on streams. So those were the areas that hit us most that we need to work on. Out of this survey, because one of the thoughts we had was we had a creel survey done on Utah Lake in 2006. And in that survey, there were very, very few largemouth bass that were harvested in that year. And I believe it was a 12-month creel. And as such, we thought that, you know, because of that real dismal harvest, that Utah Lake could stand a more liberal limit on it. And when we surveyed the original survey, it was split 50-50. And so we followed up that original survey, the statewide survey, with one that was just specific to Utah Lake and really wanted to pinpoint the bass anglers that frequent Utah Lake and get their thoughts on how they would like Utah Lake managed. And so, like the statewide survey, it was basically split 50-50. And the most numerous comments were, you know, people were real supportive of the carp removal. They felt that that was benefiting Utah Lake. They wanted more law enforcement presence, which, you know, based on the statewide, it's just kind of one of those themes that goes through everywhere. And then they wanted more shoreline access. And I did bring some brochures specific to that because I think that there is angler access on Utah Lake that people aren't aware of, and we need more, but I don't believe that people really understand what is available right now. So I brought some of those today. As a result, we're not pursuing the black bass change on Utah Lake at this time. We need to work with the Central Region to get a better idea of what's going on there, and we need to work more closely with the public so that they understand what regulations do for a bass population, how it can benefit Utah Lake perhaps, and then, you know, what it is right now. So we're going to hold off on that. And that's it. And at the end of this, I do have an informational slideshow, but Fred, if you want to vote on that, or I could do the informational right now. Where are you? Fred?
How long will it take?
5 minutes, maybe?
That's good.
Okay. All right. This is, you know, the last several years we've been talking about illegally introduced fish and species of animals. And this is just based on the Forsyth, issue where we presented it in the statewide, we know that we have work to do. So we figured that this would be a good opportunity to kind of let people know what we're faced with. Illegally introduced fish or species is probably the biggest threat to fisheries in the state of Utah. It's pandemic. It's not just in Utah. It's everywhere in the West and in the United States. We're not the only state dealing with this. Most other states are flailing at this problem as we speak and trying to figure out, you know, what works and what doesn't work as far as responses to this problem. We need to expend additional effort in education about illegal fish movement in every capacity. Just to give you an idea of what waters have been affected in Utah so far, and it's a pretty substantial list. I'm not going to go through them, but I thought that it would, you know, give you some idea as to what we're facing. It's growing. You know, Montana had, I believe, 492 illegally introduced incidents last year, and we're headed that way sooner or later. So those are the waters in Utah that have presently been affected. I'm sure that there are others that we're unaware of, but these are just the ones that we've documented. These are the species of fish that we have documented so far, and this list, again, is growing, and there's some that you know, you may not think could exist in Utah, but they seem to. A lot of these we found in Utah Lake, believe it or not. So, and this list grows every day. You know, every it seems like once a month someone brings in a strange fish, which I have to get online and figure out what the heck it is, because it's not in any of my manuals.
Tell us about the crocodile, please.
It's been several in the Jordan River, and they just, every so often, someone releases one. It was 2 or 3 feet, Mike.
We've also seen them down in some golf course ponds down in the creek.
So where are they? How do they get them into the state to come
up? At the end. All right. Okay. The cost of this action, reduce survival of native species. In many of the places where we have issues with native species, it's because there was an introduced fish. Down in the Virgin River, it's red shiner. And likewise, statewide, we have problems with Utah chubs, which are native to Utah, but not native to certain drainages where they cause issues. And there's a chance where we have ESA listing of native species as a result. Their chemical and physical treatment costs, these are fish removal efforts that we undertake annually to battle this problem. And we have one scheduled for Forsyth this fall. The one on Strawberry cost $1.3 million, I believe. 3.8, and we just got done with Panguitch Lake 2 years ago, and that one was just under 500,000, as I recall. So these are expensive efforts to remove the fish. There's a loss of anglers and associated revenue that those anglers bring the state of Utah and the Division of Wildlife. Utah is really a trout state. There's an increasing segment of warm water fish folks, but by and large, people love their trout here. And when you add a Utah chub to trout fisheries or a yellow perch to trout fisheries, the result is less quality trout. And so it does affect the revenue. And then, like I said, trickle-down effects to local and state economy. Lower survival of stocked fish. You know, if you stock walleye, for example, illegally in a water where we have trout, such as Deer Creek, the result is you can no longer manage it with a, you know, sub-catchable. You have to manage it with a catchable. The cost of that, stocking that larger fish, like the difference between an 8-inch fish and a 10-inch fish, is twice the money. So if you move from managing a stocked fish as an 8-incher to a 10-inch, you basically double your bill. And that bill is incurred by us, which in result affects anglers, either in less fish or a higher license cost, or our decreased ability to do our job. So what actions do we have? We have chemical treatment, physical removal, use of sterile fish, which is coming along. There are sterile walleye available. There are wipers available. And we're using those right now. There's more that are available every day. Idaho is using these super male brook trout, which are basically a brook trout with an extra gene, an extra male gene. And so they basically create an all male population, in theory. And over the course of 3 generations, you can eradicate a brook trout population or really diminish it where you can get on top of it. You can, you know, we have complete water closures and regulation changes, which we've implemented so far. This is something that we're considering in the future as a result of an illegal introduction. This is a list, and I mentioned yellow perch earlier. Yellow perch are on this list because when people move any fish off this list, it's because they want to harvest them wholesale. These are really fecund species. They reproduce rapidly, grow quickly. And as such, you know, when you see one and you're a fisherman, you want to go catch it and take home a bunch so you can eat them. And so one thought that we've been considering that's actually been implemented in British Columbia is close to possession of that fish species in that water if it was illegally introduced and if we don't want to manage it. And so that's an option that we might consider in the future.
So it's catch and kill, but you've got to put it back in the water?
No possession. It means that you can't take it. You have to put it back.
Live or dead?
Yes, live or dead. It just can't come home with you.
Well, I know. That's the hard fish, right? You're not killing them.
Well, the thought is, and this goes along with this slide here. I'll move forward, and then we'll talk about them both, okay? The second one is for trophy fish. And these are what would be deemed as catch and kill regulation warranted if we move in this direction. These are fish where when people move them into it, it isn't to take them home. It's that they want to catch a big one. And these people, you go down to Yuba, and most people turn back to Northern Pike. And as a result, you know, your limit is not effective. And there's a misperception of anglers that they can control a population by taking one home of these species. And it's impossible. You can't remove them all. And so it really creates a missed message to the anglers that they're helping us by taking them home, that they're going to remove them and be able to take care of this problem when in fact they can't. Does that make sense?
Drew, I think it's important to note here that the reason for this action is not a biological control. It's not anything to do with what happens if that fish is stopped. What it is trying to plant in the minds of people that if you move this fish, you cannot generate the benefit from it that you expect to get. So it's a disincentive to do the move in the first place. It's not to control what has happened, but try to prevent what might happen.
And I'm going to point out again, these are not things that we're going to do. These are things that we're considering. And it may get to a point where we have to take some radical action in order to, you know, provide people the knowledge that we won't manage these. And
it's
that we
can do bring comes to mind.
Yeah, that does.
Most people, like the white bass, for example, yeah, you can bring them 100 of them once, right? And that's it. And then you just go out and catch them, really. Yeah. And so I don't know if the logic is sound.
Well, right now there is no sound logic because nothing we've done seems to have had an impact on, you know, illegal fish movement. And so, you know, the one thing that we do acknowledge is that we are not social scientists. You know, I don't understand why a person does that. And so one of the things that we are going to undertake is a research project that we can get at, you know, what message do we need to send to an angler that will stop this? You know, if people can sell cigarettes at the rate they're selling, even though it kills you, there must be a message that they're passing, you know, that does that. We need to find that. You asked, there was a question, Fred, about where these fish come from. It's split. We have bait fish introductions, we have game fish introductions, and we have aquarium fish introductions. And they all have their, you know, separate route to our waters. Most of those, you know, those odd fish, the koi, the knife fish, the piranha, those are aquarium fish, and there's a lot of under the table exchange and purchases of those fish online, and there's even a society in Salt Lake where people can go and trade those fish. You know, we found a number of them in the aquarium stores up in Utah that are illegally. They're illegal to have here in Utah, and it's just one of those things where, you know, you have a lot of different routes. Right now, there's no real oversight into that end of things. You know, the Department of Agriculture really doesn't deal with aquarium fish. We don't deal with aquarium fish. It's a real, you know.
You could.
Well, someone has to. Right now, I think I read it's a $14 billion industry, you know, worldwide. And it's a big dog. And, you know, when we talked about it in a meeting, it was, you know, what are you going to do? Who's going to fight that battle? Who has the money to fight that industry? And so it is an important issue, and we are going to take it on. So over the next several years, we may even hire some people to help us.
Is there a cartel?
That's it.
Thank you, Drew. Appreciate the presentation on the action item, and as well as that other presentation. That was very, very educational. I'm going to bring us back to the action item and ask RAC members if you have any questions or clarification for Drew. Chris.
A few questions. First, is there a bag limit for crocodile? One question that I had, and I'm sure it's the reason why a lot of people are here, is why was it ever illegal for night shooting of carp or bow shooting of carp at night? Why was it ever illegal?
I don't know that it was ever. It was always that this was a hunting-oriented state, and I think it's a fairly new interest, and at least here. And it's just one that in our books, in our statute, it doesn't really specifically say anything about fishing at night with a light. It says that it's illegal to spotlight at night for certain species of animals. And it's only legal to do so for other species of animals. So what we're going to do is just, you know, gear it so that it includes this in that statute. The reason why is you know, we've never had an interest before. It never really came up.
So it was never intentionally?
No.
It was just kind of pumped in with
something. It was in a loophole.
And the other question I had was, do you know from other states at what rate there could be a misidentification of species, if that's a real real consideration or a...
It happens, I'm sure. We've had instances here in Utah, I'm sure. I've heard of one June sucker being shot in a tributary by an archer, or at least they suspect it was by an archer. And that's why we closed the tribs. If you look at it the same as spearfishing, their limits, although this is just specific to carp, if they did kill one, it would probably count toward their bag limit for that species of fish.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, though there's no research or anything that says that at night that could be at a higher rate, or that's not a real...
No. The only thing I did read up on it, and I will tell you that it's very popular back east, and I didn't read any negative, I didn't get any negative feedback or see anything from any other state agencies about, you know, this act. And I would imagine that it's much the same as what we see here. You know, back there, they have lakes where carp are an issue. And it just so happens that these guys probably frequent those waters that carp are an issue. And so, you know, if you're after, you know, a bag of fish that weighs the most at night, or want to, you know, pursue a fish that you can really have a good time on, you're not going to take one that's scarce. You're probably going to take the one that's most abundant.
Okay. Thank you.
Other questions for Chris? I mean for Drew. Matt.
So, Drew, what can you explain disposal? What does that mean? I mean, if you go out and... you know, shoot a bunch of carp, can you leave them there? Can you take them home and throw them in your dumpster? What does that mean?
Well, right now these guys basically work with the state parks at their tournaments, which they already have, during the day. And what they do is they put them in a dumpster and then haul them to a landfill. And that'll probably be what we have to spell out in statute. If you kill a carp, you know, like at Lake Powell, there's an unwritten rule where if you kill a striped bass that's really emaciated, skinny, and the meat isn't any good, you know, it's always been kind of one of those under table things where you puncture its air bladder and you release it so it sinks down to the bottom. And that, if you kill one, would probably be the preferred way to dispose of it.
So throwing them on the bank or leaving them out in the water, that's not...
Leaving them in the water if you puncture their air bladder would be an appropriate way to dispose of one.
Drew, can I ask you that? Yeah. One thing on this, you know, the tournament angler, that's not where there's a concern or issue. In fact, a lot of these guys here are very good about that, organizing how do we dispose of these fish. It's the weekend warrior. You know, if I want to go down Friday night and shoot 10 carp, how can I legally do that? Dispose of those fish. I don't want to carry them back to my truck with me. We don't want them pitched onto the bank because then other public see that. Hey, there's a problem here. So we're just trying to address that and allow these guys the opportunity to go and do that, but yet get rid of those fish legally, if you will. And the preferred way is if you can't take them back to your truck and dispose of them and puncture them and come back to the water.
Then, release them on the water.
Since we always see those pictures.
Other questions? Are there questions from the audience or clarification on Drew's presentation? This is not the time for comments. Just if you have a question, if you'll just come up to the microphone and let us know who you are and ask your question.
My name is Josh Noble. I'm the president of the Utah Bow Fishing Association. Drew, I got a question for you. On the legalization of bow fishing at night for common carp, what are the legalities and how are you planning on working with the state parks as far as trolling under power at night with the, you know, the high wattage lights that we have that blind the navigation lights, you know, through the sport of bow fishing at night?
That's not our authority. How's that?
Okay.
That'll have to be worked out with state parks and the entity. Just like when you go through and you get a special use permit or you show up, you're going to have to work with them because they have their own regulations for boating that we don't have.
Okay, so yeah. We're going to legalize it, but then we're going to have to go through another step with the state parks, understanding that we don't sit idle. We're going to be under power of some sort, whether it's a trolling motor or even in your slide, you know, seeing that airboat, they're moving forward. I don't know what the legalities are of that.
Well, I'd be happy to talk to state parks with you.
Okay.
And you know, they're not unreasonable any more than we are. And, you know, they look at this as a gate fee for them, too.
Sure.
And it's not impossible. And I'm probably, you know, you guys in the past, I've heard, have done this before.
We have.
So
we're actually hosted
it's already taken. Yeah, it's already taken place at night.
Right. Okay. One other question is that permissible. Just again, going back with what Matt had mentioned, just more clarification on the disposal of common carp. We understand that in the regulations, you can't throw them up on the bank. But again, the recreational bow fishermen, like what we were talking about, we just need a black and white, paragraph in the guidebook. This is exactly what we're supposed to be doing, understanding that bow fishing is growing compoundedly year after year. We just want to be able to educate the general public, the recreational bow fisher, on the proper disposal way or the proper way to dispose of these common carp. So we don't throw them up on the bank. We don't leave them in the water if that's illegal, but we just need to have it in black and white. And if it is, leave them in the water, make sure you puncture the air bladder and that they sink. That would be nice.
We'll do it.
All right. Thank you.
You bet.
Thank you. Other questions? I'll go ahead and close the question period then and open it up for comments. Any additional cards that want to bring it up? Okay. Let me remind you, if you're representing yourself, please try and limit your comments to 3 minutes. If you're representing an organization, try and limit your comments to 5 minutes. Thank you. And let's start out with Pat Scowden.
I'll be brief, but I won't be short. Got two cards up there. Both of them are involved with bait regulations on Utah Lake. First one I'd suggested a couple of years ago, and that is to allow the use of corn for those that want to fish for carp. It's a non-trout lake. Corn is very good for carp, and a lot of times I try to help fathers get their kids into some fish down there, and that's all they care about is being able to catch a big fish, either for the kids or for bait. So hard to see the downside of using carp or using corn for carp. The second one is if carp are the cockroaches of Utah Lake, white bass are the sand fleas. And since there's no limit on white bass and they are a detriment to the June suckers, it's good to remove as many as possible. I go down with a cast net and fish baskets to net baby carp to use for bait. But at this time of the year, all I can get is a bunch of 3-4 inch white bass. Now, those have to be released by law, but I was hoping possibly for some kind of a relaxing of that during the time of the year when there are swarms of baby white bass to be able to keep some of the ones that you catch, incidentally or on purpose, to use for bait because they're very good for catfish and walleye. I'll also throw out one comment. There was a question as to why bow fishing at night was outlawed. I've been fishing Utah Lake since back in the 1960s, and I was also a bow fisherman at that time. And the explanation I received from a DNR officer at that time was that they were trying to avoid having people shooting walleye at night. As most of us know, when you shine a light on a walleye at night, the eyes shine right back at you, so that makes them an easy target for a bow fisherman. That's my piece.
Thanks for your comments. Keith Kenneth Vaughn.
Thank you. Yes, I represent an organization called Chairbound Hunters, and I've got several of my members here tonight. Wes Nuttall over here with the sunglasses, Ryan Johnson, and Ken Vaughn, my grandson. You might wonder why Chairbound Hunters is interested in fishing, and I'll tell you that. We've partnered with a nonprofit called Hand in Hand Outdoors by Captain Steve Henline, out of Spanish Fork, and we have a 11-foot by 35-foot pontoon boat that we're in the process of reconfiguring it so that it'll handle wheelchairs easily, and wheelchair fishermen, and wounded warriors, and so on and so forth. And one of the things we were excited about was maybe being able to do some bow fishing. Well, as it turns out, there's a limit or restriction on using a crossbow. Some of our members, particularly quadriplegics and some of our paraplegics, can't handle a regular bow, but they can handle a crossbow and have an assistant cock it for them. And so we were wondering if we could propose that there be an allowance to be able to use it, similar to what you use for maybe archery for deer. Go to the DWR, show that you fall within this category, and that this would help you be able to bow fish. We have some equipment that we can take people out on, and we certainly won't want to do anything illegal. So we'd just like as a proposal for you to consider that allowance. Not just any handicapped hunter, because, you know, there are some people with other handicaps that they can still use regular archery. I'd say if you could limit it to a paraplegic or quadriplegic that are confined to a wheelchair, because they could even go out on a dock sometimes and do it, that's our proposal. And I would appreciate it if the board members would consider it.
Thank you, Kenneth. And gentlemen, thank you for being here tonight. Drew, are you prepared to comment on that?
I made a note, and we'll start working on it. That's all I can say. Okay? Thank you.
Barry Rimerson?
Close enough.
Tell me how you pronounce your last name.
It's Rimash.
Thank you.
That's better than most people get. So. I'm here representing the United Wildlife Cooperative. After this was an independent survey of just our members, but we did a separate survey of our members, and of the following items that are on today's agenda, we just had the following results, and hence our organization supports these following items. Our members and hence us definitely support what is proposed for the Blacksmith Fork. There is also strong support for what is proposed for the Weber River. But in addition, our survey indicates that there's support for this approach being considered for enhancing cutthroat populations in other streams that have small populations that are perhaps suppressed by the browns or harvest or any number of possible causes, hence hopefully increasing the number of reproductive Bonneville cut populations that we have available to us. Our survey, as most of the people here might like to hear, did support. There was a lot of comments that we also received about allowing the nighttime carp fishing, the bow fishing, so we definitely support that. There is definite support also for the Fish Lake proposal as well. Finally, this was not an agenda item or a proposed agenda item for this meeting. However, our survey indicates strong support among our members for not changing the regulations at Minersville Reservoir. We are aware of a movement going afoot down there for that to be, for regulations to be changed at Minersville. And our organization at this time would not support that. That's all I have.
Thank you, Barry. Greg Porter.
I'm Greg Porter. I'm representing myself. I wanted to talk about spearfishing and a proposal to have the spearfishing season regulations mirror the hook and line regulations. The current opening of the spearfishing is the first Saturday in June. I think this last year was a good example for us, where the weather was so good and the water was early, and we missed a lot of what traditionally would have been the spear fishing season this year. We also are very pleased with the allowance of spear fishing at Blue Lake. But we'd like to have the spear fishing year-round as well.
Thank you very much for your comments, Greg. Doug Burrell.
Yeah, I represent the local dive shop here in town, Scuba Ted's, and we also would like to kind of mirror the same comments made by this gentleman here. Also, a lot of our motivation for Blue Lake, I was diving there before the tilapia was introduced, and it used to be a real clear, good visibility lake. And with the introduction of tilapia, they have nesting patterns that basically just destroy the bottom, disrupt the sediment, and just make the lake just completely murky. And it's now not a very good lake to dive in as a result of it. So we're kind of motivated to remove that fish from the lake and have a little bit of fun doing it. So that's, we just would like to promote that. So thank you.
Thanks very much. Jay Ashworth.
Can I change my comments just slightly there? Is that all right? Okay. So I think it looks like the bow fishermen are out in force, to say the least. And I appreciate Drew making the comments that he did make. I've got two questions. One was that we didn't hear anything about the wipers. I read in the regulations this year, and I couldn't help but laugh what happened last year when you tried to produce wipers here in Utah. I thought it was, I mean, laughing kind of a comedy of errors laugh, if you will. So I'd like to find out what we're doing there, because I think that would be interesting to find out whether or not we're going to be able to do that. The second question I'd have is on the community fisheries. You've got Bill Lloyd taking out all these carp by the 6 million pounds a year, and I also, my understanding is that he's taking out the white bass as well. We know that you could introduce white bass into the community fisheries, and then you could up the limits. The problem we have with a lot of the community fisheries is, okay, we're going to be able to go there. We can only catch two fish, and we're going to have to, you know, leave or throw the rest back. You've got millions and millions and millions of pounds of white bass in Utah Lake we're trying to get out of anyway. Could we introduce those in the community fisheries without having a catastrophe? Thank you.
Thank you. Josh Noble.
Josh Noble, the president of the Utah Bow Fishing Association. We just, as speaking for our member group, we just support Drew and the division in their recommendations for legalizing bow fishing at night for common carp. That's it.
Thank you. And by raise of hand, all of you guys who are here tonight to support your, best to see how many of you are here. Great. Thanks for your turnout. And finally, George Summer.
Actually, I didn't need to address the council. I just want to support the division's recommendations for the fishing regulations and guide order.
All right. Thank you very much. Anyone else like to make a comment tonight before we bring it back to the rack? Come on up and tell us your name.
Jared Golding, representing myself. I just got a question for Drew. If you've got too many fish in the blacksmith, why don't you go electrocute, scoop them up, and take them down the sand pitch where they all died off with the fire?
They're just disease issues that we'd have to cross, and the ash flows in the sand pitch are probably a little high yet, so that we will introduce fish in there. It's just a matter of when.
Okay. Again, thank you for your comments. We'll bring it back to the RAC for your comments and disposition.
I'd like to ask a question of Drew and then maybe a comment. Would it be any problem at all to include crossbow fishing for the wheelchair-bound hunters in the aspect of night fishing for carp? Is that a problem?
Well, when I was sitting there thinking, we already have an allowance. You can go in and get a license as a handicapped person to bow hunt with a crossbow. And I just need to go and make sure what the legality is with this, with fishing. Because I would assume that all you'd have to do is go in and get that permit that would allow you to do so. And I don't believe there's a cost. I just need to check. And I did get his contact information, and I'll do so, and I'll get with him. But I don't think it's going to be any bigger issue than just getting a piece of paper that says, you know, that you can do it.
That's the reason I was asking that, because if we make a motion, I'd like to include that in just the RAC's recommendation that the handicapped hunter be allowed to hunt with a crossbow.
If I could make a recommendation to just add it in with the maybe taking from the vehicle, because that's, you know, just specific to us.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe that's where that would fall in.
I think, you know, probably, and John might correct me if I'm wrong, or Fred, I think what would be appropriate is if the RAC recommended that we work with this group to find out, you know, and pursue an allowance for bow fishing with a crossbow.
That's kind of where I'm
going. Yeah, and not included in the packet that would be voted on tonight.
So we get it somehow.
Yep.
It could be dealt with by the board.
Right, it could be.
Well, that's why I was wondering.
Can I add one quick comment? When I go and get my permit to choose a crossbow, it's good for the rest of the year, covering, you know, whatever species I'm using it for. Is that just add it right in there,
right,
for bow fishing too?
Yeah, that's what I'm thinking.
All it really needs.
Right, and it might be something that we could do fairly quickly. I just need to check on it, but I think a recommendation from the RAC to pursue it would be appropriate.
You have two
thoughts come to mind here, but
you'd want to address. One is that if you're using crossbows to get it passed, would be that you would have it where they would be required to have some kind of line on the arrow, which you would assume they would anyway.
Yeah.
And then probably have a minimum as opposed to a maximum poundage that you'd want them shooting the fish. Just for, you know, if an arrow gets away from you, you want to be able to manage that. Unlike deer hunting, well, in Utah it's not so much because there's so many hunters, but the point is getting the arrow away from you out with a crossbow would go significantly farther unless you put a maximum poundage that you'd allow them to shoot fish. Does that make sense?
I think those are all good comments, and maybe, Duane, what you could do is put your motion into something that basically suggests to the board that they deal with this issue.
Let me try.
Yeah, go ahead.
I'd like to make a motion to the board that we have Drew and the division appropriate Drew and the appropriate Division of Wildlife people meet with the wheelchair-bound people and formulate a way of them being able to night fish for carp or whatever else, and to do that as quickly as it can be done so that they can take advantage of that.
Can you make a motion to actually put it in the regulations this next?
Well, I said as quickly as they can do it. If they can't do it, that's why I added that. That's going to be up to Drew and them to get it done as quickly as they can.
One comment. We keep talking about night bow fishing. Can it just be bow fishing in general instead of, you know, pigeonholing it so that they can only use a crossbow at night?
that's what we're after.
Yeah. I mean, just bow fishing, period.
Right.
Right.
Yeah, if it's stated they can bow fish, then it automatically fall under any of the regulations that come about.
There you go. Better.
You want to see them at a tournament, by the way.
That's right.
They're all trying to help you with this motion.
I understand, and that, yeah. All we got to do is...
The smaller the room, the more collective the effort, you know?
But I think we just got to take the word night out of it to facilitate accommodating the wheelchair-bound hunters to be able to, or bow fishermen to be able to bow fish with a crossbow, plain and simple.
Amanda, are you good with that?
She'll figure it out.
And we need a second?
Second.
Okay, we've got a second over here from Richard, and that's the extent of your motion?
Yeah, I don't want to put a package here because I think...
Okay, further discussion? All those in favor? Opposed? And it passes unanimously. Okay, where do we want to go now? Gary.
I make a motion that we accept the changes proposed by the division in the with the fishing rule regulations.
Okay, is there a second to that? Second by Matt. Further discussion? All those in favor? Opposed? And that passes unanimously. I'd just like to say, for those of you who had additional suggestions tonight, I know that Drew will take those into consideration. We didn't act on some of your recommendations, but I think they were all good ones. And so I know that Drew and the fishing folks will take a look at all of those, including corn.
Yep.
and regulations on tiny white bass. So all good comments and suggestions, and we will certainly pass those along, and they will be in our minutes for the board. Any new business that we need to take on tonight? If not, for those of you who are interested, the board will be taking up this subject at their meeting on November 1st, and our next RAC meeting will be in this room on
November 8th.
November 8th.
Yeah, nothing happens in October but hunting and fishing.
Hunting and fishing in October. Again, thank everybody for being here tonight. We appreciate your coming out. And RAC members, thank you for making it a quorum. And we'll see you in November. And have a great October.
Thank you.